started, we got a couple of things on the agenda this afternoon. First up, we've got a review of the dog leash law requirements. And again, this comes to us at a request of some citizens that approached the council and asked us to take a look at our leash law. Brent, you're going to step us through this. You did a little research.
I'll try it. Yep.
Go ahead.
So as Mr. Saber mentioned, back on March 2nd, the council did hear from some individuals who thought the current leash regulations in Rochester were not restrictive enough. So I did go out and reviewed 11 other cities regarding their leash laws, and I did send a memo to the council and mayor back on March 9th with those findings of the cities that I looked at, and basically most of the cities do require that animals be on leashes, ranging anywhere from like 10 feet all the way up to 25 feet in length and on leashes. Chapter 106 in the city of Rochester talks about animals, and in particular, there talks about, and there's definitions in there, animals or dogs must be by command, which means that whenever a owner is walking, jogging, or bicycling public property or private property of another, a dog must be within 6 feet of its owner at all times. And the dog must be adhere to that command so it can return to the owner within two voice commands. So that's the current regulations that are found in the city of Rochester. So it doesn't require an animal to be on a leash. It just has to be within command of its owner, and it has to return to the owner on two voice commands. So if you look at the memo, look at the cities of Apple Valley, Austin, Byron, Edina, Lakedale, Mankato, Minneapolis, Owatonna, Plymouth, St. Cloud, and St. Paul. And like I said previously, states in the memo that most of those cities do require their animals to be on leashes. So the memo states that the council, if they want to discuss this, you can discuss if you want to look at amending Chapter 106A regarding your leash regulations for dogs in particular.
All right, Mr. Wojcik?
Well, I did get a lot of comments on this, so I did promise everyone that there would at least be some opportunity for them to weigh in before we would make an official decision. A lot of the people who weighed in on this didn't realize that we don't make formal decisions in our committee meeting. They have to come to the council, but I did want to advocate that if we're going to do anything, let's make sure we have some sort of opportunity for public comment. It doesn't have to be a hearing, but let's at least put the word out there to any changes that we're considering. I wanted to ask Mr. Svenby about Lakeville, because I'm particularly interested in Lakeville, because what they do is they say that animals must be on a leash, but they'll offer an exception if the dogs has passed canine good citizen test certification. I think a comment made earlier was that all of these laws that are in place tend to be in place not for the 90% of responsible dog owners, but for the 10% are not. But that doesn't change the fact that we still have to address those 10%. And, this would be a tool to do that. But what they do in Lakeville is there's some criteria. If the criteria is met, the dog cannot be on a leash. Do you have any discussion with them? Or?
No, I just pulled the information off their website. Okay. It looks like if your canine can go through some type of training classes with their city, that passes that class, and it does not need to be on leash.
Brent, I had a question, and this is based on a couple of questions I received. Do the other cities allow some exceptions for certainly like a dog park, or the one that was brought to my attention, some dogs for recreation, they do disc competition and so forth. How are those situations treated? Do they allow for exemptions in their ordinance?
Not that I found. I can go back and look into that. See anything in particular regarding that?
Boy, I would sure assume the dog parks would just be assumed
it
to be.
It should be, right. Yeah. But it depends on how it's written. And again, the disc competitions were the ones that were brought to my attention. In fact, I believe that's even a Rochester Fest event where we have a disc competition with trained animals.
Some really fast
dogs. Yeah, in particular, like the city of Owatonna requires pets to be on a leash in a public park, and Owatonna just opened up a dog park last fall, so those dogs in that public dog park to be off the leash. Mm-hmm.
Okay, other questions, comments?
Do we have ordinances in Owatonna?
Mr. Hickey.
Now, on the cities you looked at, Brent, I see Byron has a command-type restraint allowed. Are there any other cities, maybe larger cities, that have a similar ordinance as our current ordinance that don't require a physical leash? So something maybe like a Duluth or?
Not from the cities that I looked at.
Okay.
I figured looking at 10 different cities, 11 different cities, that's pretty ample, but I can go look at other cities if you want me to.
I'm just curious. I mean, it seems, ours seems to be unusual from what I can tell. And in this list, you know, I see Byron, but I don't see many others that have, you know, an ordinance similar to ours.
Yeah, most of the cities require dogs to be on leashes. So.
Okay. And then, and I don't know if this is a question for the city attorney, what's enforcement look like, and how do we do that if we were going to require a leash law?
Well, we would amend the ordinance by removing the by command language.
Yep.
And that comes into play with the running at large prohibition. These citations are issued when dogs are running at large, and right now running at large is defined as not being on a leash or not being on voice commands, so we would have to change those. Otherwise, we've made this an administrative fine violation, so it can be enforced through the administrative fine process.
And then is it like animal control can issue,
yes,
and police officers and CSOs?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Anyone else? Mr. Campion.
So I did a little, I got a few emails as well, and some people that obviously have some passion about their animals when they're taking them out, and I'm kind of leaning toward trying to find a compromise here. I think that there's a little bit of room. I don't think that a leash law is there to hinder owners that may not be using leashes today, may think their dogs are the best in the world. It's there to give a sense of security to people who are approaching an owner with a dog that doesn't know whether that dog is well-trained or not. I think there's certainly some reason to be considerate in that respect. Well, some of the feedback I got was also the disc dogs, as well as if you're taking a dog for a hike, things like that. And I would wonder if there's a way that maybe we could just change the language to require leash when you're maybe like on a public sidewalk, on maybe like a trail of some variety, any of those sorts of ways that, you know, you can plan on being in pretty close contact with other people versus when you're kind of in the middle of the woods or something like that, the likelihood of you kind of coming close contact with someone. In fact, this being enforced at all in the middle of the woods is probably kind of maybe infeasible, but I think that there's maybe some middle ground. I'd hope there'd be a middle ground we could reach where we don't kind of burden people that do that as a sort of recreation, and we can still kind of maybe get some of the security out of it.
Mr. Rogers?
Now, one thing on the other side that I do want to bring up too, because I see this firsthand that a lot of times, typically if I see a dog off leash anywhere in the city, pretty good idea that dog is pretty well behaved and you can figure that out fairly quickly. But you know, one thing that happens a lot is the dogs will still come up to you and, you know, say hi or whatever, and you know, I don't have any issue with this, but I do have a 7-year-old, and she's despite the fact that we have a dog, she's terrified. And I know these dogs that are coming up to her are friendly and there's not any real issue there, but it doesn't change the fact that, you know, my own daughter is really scared when this is happening. So, and you know, I don't think it's necessarily bad behavior by the dogs, but I am aware of that too, that some people, and it's not just kids, are truly terrified of dogs based on their own experience. And you know, that under control is going to have to, you know, whatever we do, there's going to have to be some understanding too, that you know, the dog should not be coming up to people in parks, even if, you know, even if it is friendly. I'm sympathetic to that because my own 7-year-old really gets scared if a dog comes up to her.
What about what Mr. Campion suggests? Certainly a leash if you're in a public setting or on a sidewalk, but if you're in a park where, you know, hardly anyone around, and especially with a bigger breed of dog, they need to run. Mm-hmm. And you know, is there room for that sort of compromise with that?
I mean, there is, but anytime we start doing these exceptions, it becomes exceedingly difficult to enforce. And, you know, I live right on Young Park, and a lot of dogs run off leash up there, and I don't have a problem with any of those dogs. But my daughters do get scared. So I think that I like what Lakeville does, where, you know, Lakeville, they require the leash unless certain threshold, and they use the canine good citizen, but we, you know, insert whatever we found to be appropriate. But I do think that if we're going to have the voice control as an optional, we need to maybe narrow down exactly what that means as well. I think that, you know, I think the owners have a little responsibility to keep their dogs close and keep them to their own, to themselves, as opposed to going out and making friends.
Mr. Adkins?
Well, a quick check on the internet shows that Eagan has the same ordinance that we have. Minnetonka has basically the same ordinance, but they break it up a bit. You have to be on a leash in parking lots within 15 feet of a paved or gravel trail, mowed grass, picnic areas, playground areas. You can be off-leash in non-mowed grassy areas, dirt paths created by people and pets in the non-mowed areas. And while they're off-leash, they must be under voice command. And so it's sort of a variation on
that. I'm sorry, which community was that?
Minnetonka.
Ms. Ruska.
I guess I'd agree with Michael's point about trying to create exceptions. You know, we all deal with dangerous dog hearings throughout the year. Not a lot of them, but I think every one we do, if you'd asked those people before, you know, these incidents, they would have said their dog was fine and easy to control and never create issues, and yet we deal with them. And I think anybody that even has a pit bull would say their pit bull is a good pit bull. It's not going to create problems. It's not going to create any issues. It wouldn't, you know, they have them under control. But just my learning over the years is the nature of dogs is if something provokes them or something happens, they can get out of their natural mindset and can create issues. So what we're trying to do here is create safety for people. Not everybody's the same comfort level with dogs as others. And so what we're trying to do here is to look at it, make sure we're creating as safe an environment as possible. And like I say, everybody thinks their dog is a safe one, and most of them are. But we all know that we deal with issues throughout the year based on those that the voice commands didn't work or something provoked them and took them out of their control of their owner and some incident happened. So I guess with that, I'd like to know, I asked Stephen if we could get someone from law enforcement or animal control to weigh in and let us know if this would be something that they have issues with or that they would support to try to enforce and so on more than we are now.
Chief?
I can at least give you a rundown of how that process works now, and we typically respond to complaints, either dogs running at large or complaints where people have been accosted by an animal, and therefore the dog at large statute comes into play. Our animal control officers and our police officers use the dog at large statute. That means they just pick up a stray dog and somebody just doesn't have any contact, just run through the neighborhood. Rare occasions, typically they take them off the animal control shelter. Person's required to come pick them up. They can be charged with dog running at large. The other scenario where somebody complains about a dog that is either not under control or aggressive. According to, I spoke to our control staff about that this morning, and I apologize, they can't quantify. Our record system doesn't differentiate in terms of what type of animal control issue it was. But our patrol staff indicates that typically the dog issues are dogs being aggressive towards other dogs, not people. It's typically other dogs that they're interacting with. Most of the time it's off the leash. Occasionally we still have those instances where a dog is on the leash and still, you know, when there's another dog either at a private residence that's in the yard or people are walking their dog, various times they can become aggressive. And particularly if there's a significant difference in the size of the dog, that can sometimes be a little problematic. So those are the bulk of them. We don't have a huge volume of those type of calls, obviously. Whether or not from an enforcement perspective, whether that changes for us, with the leash requirement. I don't look at it as a particular enforcement issue. Obviously, it's we're enforcing the terms of the ordinance. So if the leash is required, we would, respond on that basis. But right now, it's a by command issue. I don't, maybe Terry could contradict me if I'm wrong. I don't think that's been a particular problem with the enforcement of the ordinance as it is. As I said, most of the time we're dealing with some aggressive interaction on the part of the animal, so obviously they weren't under control, whether they were on a leash or not. So that's really the essence of, I guess, what we're responding to in terms of complaints from the public.
Okay. Other comments, questions? Direction. Ms. Means.
I'm just curious, Mr. City Attorney, you read one from Mankato. Can you read that one again, the audience?
It was Minnetonka.
Minnetonka?
I didn't keep it, though.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, I like the idea of having the leash law. I like dogs. I've had dogs for decades. All of them were over 80 pounds. But I've also had children, and I've been to the dangerous dog charities, and I've seen some of the children with the bites. And so I think, I'm in favor of the leash law with some variation to accommodate when you're not on city sidewalks or not on, pavement or not in the city, but on grassy areas, some other exception. And I think the words that city attorney cited fit in well with my thinking. And I'm sorry, I didn't write it down.
Non-mowed grassy areas, dirt paths created by people and pets in the non-mowed areas. Dogs can be under voice command while on these off-leash areas. So basically, Minnetonka separated the leash areas from the off-leash areas and indicated voice command was sufficient for the off-leash areas.
Hmm. All right.
And that's the one that I think would be agreeable to most of the people, just to give some flexibility.
Mr. Nygberg, you have a question, a comment from the
comment for you. There's actually a compatible ordinance, I think it's 45 and 46B, that talks about the same leash control in parks as well. And I think if you look at the distinguishing factor between sidewalk trails and public right-of-way versus parks, I think it's a good idea, frankly. We see a lot of people out in our parks using the parks for exercise and activity, things like that. And if the dogs are under control, which I've seen a lot of off-leash, it really is not a problem. It's that 10%, 5% that really cannot control the dogs by voice command that becomes a problem.
Yeah, you're right. It's 45B. And you talk about they have to be responsive to a command. Mr. Campion?
I was just going to say, I mean, one way we can work our way through this is if we agree that events like disc, being able to play disc with your dog, or hold events that have, frisbee dogs and stuff like that, that happened at a park across the street from me in Lincolnshire, there was no complaints. In fact, the neighborhood basically loved having that event take place. Those dogs are off the leash. So if we kind of start from that's a thing we would like to enable, then we can work back from, what would we not like to see. And the principal thing that I'm hearing is public safety. I think one of the things, you're walking through a neighborhood where there are all sorts of dogs that have carved out their own territory, their yard is their territory, those sorts of things. To me, it's reasonable to expect when you come walking through my neighborhood and my yard where my kids might be playing, you keep your dog on a leash. That to me isn't too onerous. I think that's a reasonable expectation for both my safety from dogs I don't know and my children's safety from dogs I don't know, and your dog's safety by the street and stuff like that. So, to me, I think the Minnetonka ordinance sounds like a really good starting spot. The one kind of caveat I heard there was mowed grass. I know some of our parks get mowed pretty large, so I think it's reasonable to say if you're in the grass portion of a park, then you could have your dog off the leash as long as they're under voice command. To me, this is kind of a common sense approach to this thing, and it's not trying to be onerous, so that would be my preference.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. You have to be reasonable. If you're on the sidewalk, a leash, but if you're playing fetch with the dog, clearly they're going to be off a leash. Mr. Ruskin?
Well, it seemed like there's enough unmowed places you could play fetch with the dog. I think about that. You know, we talk about fairly a park that doesn't have very many people there. What if it's a grandpa that took his grandkid out to play on the swing set for the day, you know, for a while, and there's not very few people there, but there's a dog that, you know, that could, you know, under voice command is only as effective as the commander and the dog and so on. But any of us that have gone on campaign understand how many dogs are in the city. There's a lot of them, and we see every kind of level of training and control, and there's some really great ones out there, and they're men's best friend and all that. But I just think we need to make sure that when people are in the public areas, they're protected. When you're walking through, like you say, walking through a neighborhood, that you're not going to have a dog. A dog can chase and scare the heck out of a little kid or a person, and then, you know, the owner can get it to come back, and okay, so it comes back. You know, I don't know. To me, there's a point here about trying to make sure that we're creating a safe community and yet allowing people the opportunity to do what they want to do. So I like the Minnetonka thing too. I'm not too sure I'm okay with the mowed parks, because I think parks are for people. You know, we have dog parks, and that's where they can take their dogs. Now, if you have a special frisbee golf event, then I think you could maybe, you know, work on getting some type of a permitting process or something of that nature where they are going to do a special event. But
I wouldn't get too hung up on the specific places within those two categories. I think the approach of Minnetonka is we have a leash area, we have a non-leash area. You folks decide what places go in those buckets.
Okay. All right, I see what you're saying.
Okay. Mr. Wojcik.
And I would just say for the parks area, I think that's one of those things that we call on our parks board to give us some recommendations on that as well.
That's a good point. And I
agree.
Mr. Campion?
I wholeheartedly agree with the idea that safety has to come first. I mean, principally, I do understand the position we put dog owners in, but realistically, the safety of, you know, all of the citizens of the community is a priority. I'm certainly trying to balance something that's reasonable. I think the Minnetonka one's a good starting spot with their leash areas and non-leash areas. If the parks are deemed by the majority of the council to be off, I would not only support that after, I would understand why that decision was made. So
it seems as though there's sentiment to to add or enhance the leash law, but allowing for some compromise, such as an example, the Minnetonka, the way they've approached it. But so then the next step might be to move this to the park board for their recommendation, with consultation from the city attorney's office on language, or what's the pleasure of the council? What do you, Mr. Wendell?
The park board would only cover parks, and so you'll have all the other areas of the city.
That's,
I think you should give them the direction for those.
True,
areas.
But they can certainly get the ball rolling as far as what they might consider acceptable areas. Mr. Ruskin?
Well, we have public and private property that we deal with in the city, and we kind of know where that stands. So the parks is an area that I think is kind of in that gray area in between it's obviously public property, but I think the park board manages the park, so I'd like to get their thoughts on it, let them make a decision on how they want to see those things mm-hmm. fit into this process. I think Michael's right on with let them decide on that. And I like Nick's point here. We need to, you know, come up with a compromise that everybody can live with. But, I think when you start getting that gray area of well, let's see how, you know, some people do better than others, I think we're opening the door or not clear on what we're doing here. So I just want to see some clarity with it. I think it makes some sense.
Okay. Mr. Wood.
Perhaps to keep this moving, might I suggest that we take what Minnetonka's done, insert the language that Lakeville has for the off-leash provision, where you have to actually meet some standards, so you can't just say, yeah, my dog's under control, and bring a draft back like that. And reason for bringing a draft back, what I'd like to do is have a draft and, you know, just let the public comment on it for a couple weeks. So that,
yeah, I agree. We've received a fair amount of comments, so I'd like to have that opportunity. Mr. Campion, and then Ms. Means.
In particular, I don't fully understand the certification programs. I don't know if part of your research you can detail that a little bit more.
But it must be just a test that's given by the animal control in Lakeville. And it's kept on file, and each year they have to update that and apply for their dog license.
If I could,
so you don't have a license.
We're taking our dogs through that same process. It's a class, it's probably 6 to 8 weeks long, and you basically teach your dog to not only be in control, but to not be reactive as you walk by people. Again, to be friendly, but not too friendly. My dogs have both failed because they're too friendly. It's like people. It's not an easy one to pass, frankly.
And so it's administered by private businesses?
Yep. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
My dog's also.
We call it a dog obedience school.
Right, yeah. I just wanted to make sure that if this was being administered by animal control, that would be an expense we'd be incurring to do this, and we'd have to figure out how to do that.
Based on the fact that my dog actually passed this exam, I'm wondering if there's maybe a higher standard that we can find.
Ms. Mean, do you have a
question? I was just thinking about the lake bill. I fully believe that 25 feet is too long of a leash.
Oh.
Not exceeding 25 feet in length. I'd like to see it more like 15 or 10.
Yeah, and my goal with the Lakeville one was only to put in the provision that if you are off leash, you have to meet some sort of criteria. If you're going to specify a length, I think, you know, a lot of people use the retractable leashes and just have it available so that it can be a shorter leash, you know, when it's...
I'm a little bit torn by that because I don't like the idea that we have some sort of certification that says you can let your dog off the leash, because I don't want it to read like that. I want it to be, you know, you're still ultimately responsible for any of the actions that your animal takes. So if you choose to do it, I think that's how we should be.
Okay.
Mr. Bildebeck.
I'm more inclined to ask the city attorney to draft an ordinance such as Minnetonka's. I'd like to see it go back to the park board and after that come back. And the only way I think realistically we can sit and have let people make comment is to bring it back as a public hearing. And so I know you say no.
I know what you're saying.
Because otherwise you're not going to give people an opportunity to speak. Yeah. They're not going to be able to hear both sides. So I think what we ought to be doing at this point is trying to set a date, ask Mr. Wedman, Mr. Nigber, when the next time park board meets and if they would be able to have that conversation. Get that information to us, and then we can set a tentative date today as far as when it comes back to the council. Mr. Hickey.
But we're asking them specifically to comment on what 45B, right? And then we're going to use that as just more information to inform us on the overall policy for the city, right?
Right, okay. Because as was stated, they primarily, their purview is in parkland, and we would be more concerned about the rest of the city.
Right.
April 7th, we can put it on the agenda for next week.
Get their comments. Okay. All right.
Mr. Atkins, how long before you have it ready?
April 7th.
Thank you.
Here in this room, 4:30.
When would you be able to have a draft ordinance?
You want me to have it before or after?
After.
April 8th.
Perfect. So when the next council meeting we have after that point, we can have a public hearing so people can have.
Okay. We'll schedule that. So
perfect.
I think that is important. It's obviously a topic of interest for a lot of people, so we should allow for that opportunity to be heard.
I was just going to say, this was brought to our attention by people that were concerned we didn't have a leash law, and I think that the public hearing allows everybody to be heard, and then we can use that comment to finalize our decision. So I'm certainly supportive of that.
Okay. All right. We'll conclude that discussion then for today, and we'll come back.
Is there a tentative date you want to put out there for when that would be heard?
For the public hearing?
Yes. That way those who are here of it with interest would have that idea.
Do you think it would be
second
prepped in time for the second?
April 20th.
Okay. So tentatively April 20th is when we would have that public hearing.
I think that's fair for the people who are here to
watch out for it.
Sometime after 7 p.m. Usually between 7 p.m. and 2 in the morning.
Hopefully not.
Don't laugh too loud.
All right, so tentatively April 20th, we'll have a public hearing on that based on feedback we get. Okay.
Perfect.
We had asked Public Works to come back with a clarification on the FOG, or the Fat, Oil, and Grease Ordinance. Mr. Freeze provided some information for us. And you're going to step us through that. We've had a few questions and emails and so forth on this one as well.
Parks Board, April 7th.
Yeah,
yeah.
April 7th is Parks. And
then what day was it going to be here?
20th.
Perfect. Thank you, guys.
You'll be there. You sort of have to be.
So the crowd wasn't here for the fog discussion?
Well, you want to drag in the door, just bring up what fog was.
Everybody's in the fog.
Fog.
So, Claire, how could we end this thing?
I can't believe this right now.
That's bring up bad soil and grease.
I thought they were all here for you, Richard.
You're saying for Bob? Great.
Did Chet stick around or did he leave too?
Let's keep going. Mr. Freeze, obviously this is an important topic. Everyone stuck around.
I can't see him down there. There's too much fog in between.
Yeah, I don't.
You want to give us an update?
What are you saying about my hair?
I didn't say who it was.
Ms. Slocum, could we? We'll take the conversation outside. Mr. Freeze, you're on.
You want to walk through the ordinance first? Is that
however you want to step us through?
Why don't we do that?
Okay.
So I just want to point out a couple of key definitions then on, in the definition section there, sub 5, food service establishment. These are people that are licensed by Olmsted County Public Health or the Minnesota Department of Ag or other state licensed agencies. So there are defined groups by the state and by the county who constitute these food service establishments. So we'll be working off of those master lists for contacts. Next one is sub 6, the grease interceptor. It means a device designed and installed so as to separate and retain fats, oils, and grease from the normal waste while permitting normal sewage or liquids to discharge the drainage system by gravity. So I think those are the two key definitions. And then I ask you to move forward to section 76C3, subparagraph 3, subdivision 3, which talks about, except as otherwise provided, new FSEs proposed or constructed with after the effective date shall be equipped with a grease interceptor that complies with the requirements of the plumbing code as adopted by the state of Minnesota and this ordinance. And so again, we've been working with building safety, and we've already actually had some recent new facilities installed that are going to the gravity interceptor in some cases, and in others cases using the hydromechanical. But we're now in full compliance, and we're on the same page with building safety in this regard. Subdivision 5, which talks about if an existing FSE is not connected or equipped with a grease interceptor, and such that it does not comply with the plumbing code, they must install a grease interceptor on a date deemed appropriate by the water reclamation plant manager after the initial inspection. And this gets back to my note that I sent you yesterday, is that everybody's grandfathered in. Everybody's good the way they are today. But as you see now, as we look at subparagraph 5, if you don't have a grease interceptor today, you will be required to install one at such point in time within a building or facility when a building or plumbing permit for the expansion of the SFE is made within the facility. So again, everybody's good the way they are, but as soon as you look to expand your current FSE and you don't have a grease interceptor, you'll have to install one. And again, you can either do the hydromechanical, which is in the building, or the gravity interceptor, which is outside of the building.
Mr. Campion.
Just to be clear, and I want to make sure this is a distinction, coming into compliance with the grease interceptor rule is a artifact of the Minnesota Plumbing Code, correct?
Yes.
We are simply going to be investigating and determining that this has been done as part of our city work to reduce fog at the plant.
Correct.
We are not instituting a new rule that they must comply with.
No, and in fact, Chapter 7603A of your current ordinances already addresses this as it relates to the discharge of general discharge prohibitions, which already currently is it illegal, the right way to use it in reference to a city?
To discharge.
It's illegal to discharge fats, oil, and grease to the sewer system, and has been since the late 1980s when this ordinance was adopted. So again, we're just creating a mechanism now for bringing people into compliance with the ordinance if they're not, and particularly the record keeping aspect of this is another important part that I'll touch on in a few minutes. Then looking at 76C04, there will be an opportunity for people to file for an exemption. And we lay out three cases where that might come in. again, our intent is to work with all the existing FSEs. Again, you're grandfathered in only if you do basically do an expansion. If there are other extenuating circumstances, we understand. And kind of our proviso on this whole thing is, though, if you aren't in compliance, you shouldn't get a free pass for those people who already have an grease interceptor and incur some cost to dispose of the grease properly. And what we're proposing is to make that playing field equal, if you will, is this surcharge fee that I'll talk about later. Because, again, if you don't have one, you are discharging your fats, oil, and grease. You're incurring no additional cost to collect them, to maintain that equipment, and have that grease removed. You're just discharging it right to the sewer, and the city's incurring some expense in doing that. Moving forward to Section 76C06, we talk about operation and maintenance. I'm sorry, I skipped a page there. I want to back up to 76.03, subparagraph 3. I guess I covered those. I'm sorry. I do want to move ahead then to 06. So operation and maintenance of all the grease interceptors. These are devices, and I think you recall from the presentation, they're not very easy to maintain. They're not very, it's not a nice job. It's not a kind of job that really is, well, my point is that they have to be properly maintained or they don't work. And so there are standards, again, as to when they're being maintained. And in fact, the statute indicates the frequency during which a grease interceptor should be maintained. And we do have a provision in here, though, if a particular establishment, through its record keeping, can demonstrate to Chet that they don't have to clean it every 3 months, again, then he can provide that variance for them. So again, it's you know, the proof is on the FSE to show us that, in fact, their grease interceptor doesn't fill to the point that the solids reach 25% of the design capacity of the interceptor. So these are standards, again, that are laid out in the statute.
Mr. Freese, I think you mentioned this somewhere along the line, but do you have a rough idea of what percent of food service establishments are non-compliant today?
Only with respect to the fact that in August of 2013, we did a survey. You want to pass that on? I've got copies. And we did a survey of all the FSEs in the community that we had a listing of from Olmsted County Public Health at that time. So they determined that there were 450 FSEs out there. Within the city, there was about 391. And we got responses from 96, about 32% of them. So about 1 in 3 responded. Of those, 50% indicated they had a grease trap. 43% indicated they did not have one, and 2% didn't know. So from this unscientific survey, if you will, it was just sent out to the FSCs, and those that chose to respond did. About a third of them, we found that half had an had a grease trap or an interceptor, and half did not. So, to answer, we really don't know, and we won't know until we do an inspection. We have attempted to work with Olmsted County Public Health in the past on this issue. Had several discussions with them about when they do their restaurant inspections, could they also do an inspection of this facility? And after a series of discussions, the final answer was no, they could not. They didn't have the time. It wasn't a requirement of their inspection. And so they basically indicated they would not be doing that. If they noticed a problem from a cleanliness perspective of grease spilling out of the interceptor or oozing up under the plate, obviously they would take issue with that, but they weren't not going to make this part of the regular inspection routine.
Yeah, I appreciate the survey, but I'm curious, has there ever been an attempt to go a little deeper We know that it can be a revenue generator if you do it right, and it also obviously saves a lot of wear and tear and plumbing repairs in your own business. So do we know why the other half possibly are not doing that?
We have talked to a couple of food service establishments, and the ones we've talked to and asked them what type of interceptor they had, they claimed they did not have one. And when we asked them, we go and take a look. We went in and they had hydromechanical interceptors. They weren't aware they were there. So when they have this 45% saying they don't have them, what that really means is they really don't know. When we opened them up, the latest, matter of fact, it was an establishment, a new establishment. They took a look at what was there, and they were pretty disgusted. And they went ahead and planned at that time to put a gravity interceptor outside the building so that they did not have this problem. They said, we had no idea we were contributing to the city's fog. And they went ahead and did the right thing.
Okay. Mr. Bilderbeck, then Ms. Ruskin.
And this brings up, poses an interesting question. Are we going to if we go ahead with this, what plan for education is there for our establishments that would need these, or should have these?
In my email, the ordinance would take effect January 1 of next year. Our intent would be to send out a letter to all FSEs that would explain the program, talk about the timelines, talk about the expectations, and then basically ask for an opportunity, you know, ask them to contact us if they have any questions. So our intent is not to send them. We could send them the whole ordinance. I think that would be
confusing,
confusing for them. Mm-hmm. But basically kind of a bullet point type letter like the memo I sent to you. But we intend to do that either before, during, or after you would adopt the ordinance. That would be our intent. But we really need indication from you. Is this something you want to do before we make that outreach effort?
But you have thought about an education.
Yep.
That's one of the major responsibilities of the fog coordinator. And there's a lot of education that goes into it. You have to educate the haulers so they know how to clean it correctly, be certified. You have to educate the food service establishments so they understand what the program are. There's a folder, a three-ring binder that goes out to all the FSEs. So once they have that, all their requirements are explained. So we're not just going to go out and hand it out. We're going to try to have meetings to bring it together. If we can't, then we will start going to the individual food service establishments. This is going to take a length of time. So we see the education component. You know, if we hired somebody, you know, 6 months' time, I don't think we can talk to every single FSE. It's going to take a while for that component. And as we do that, there are many food service establishments will start to come by, and then we'll start to see some of the outcomes.
Okay. Mr. Ruska.
Chad, can you tell me the places you said you went out and talked to a couple places that had it, didn't realize they had it? Which places were those?
Well, there are actually...
we'd rather not name names, that's okay.
There are new establishments that Building Safety talked to, and Building Safety is aware of the new ordinance. And they said, you know, there's new ordinance coming out. These are the requirements that they're going to be. If you want to be in compliance with that, this is what you need to do. And one of them, one of our neighbors talked to us, and we went over with them and investigated, and they said yes. And actually, the plumbers were involved also. Local plumbing agency also heard that we were considering this, and so they wanted to know something about it, and they contacted us. So next month, April 16th, I think it is, I'm going to be meeting with the Plumbing Association to inform them of the new ordinance, assuming that, you know, we're going ahead with it. But they are interested so they know of what they can help out the food service establishments with requirements.
And that will probably be our best outreach partner, will be the licensed plumbers in the community.
Well, why not the restaurants? I mean, why don't you coordinate a meeting with the restaurants so that they can understand this? Because that's where we're getting the concern is from the restaurant owners now not knowing and thinking they're going to see a bunch of more fees and a bunch more red tape and a lot of issues that they're going to have to deal with because they don't understand it. There are two
customers here. One is the people who are doing the work, and that's the plumbers. They will be educated. They know what the requirements are, and they will be able to know when they go into an establishment to make modifications what the expectations are of the city and how they can communicate that to the restaurant owner. But also, again, I completely agree with you. We want to do that, but you know we really didn't want to get out there too far in front of you and say that, you know, we're considering all of this if you are not supportive of the concept. Of,
well,
you know,
I see a lot of good things in this, but if I'm a plumber, I'm all for this. But if I'm a restaurant owner, you know, I mean, that's what I'm getting at is, you know, plumbers are like, yeah, this is, you know, this is more work, this is good stuff. But if you're a restaurant owner and you're seeing more fees and, gee, $100,000 a year position, well, how are we going to pay for that? We're going to have to pay for that by assessing fees and creating costs on the restaurants. The restaurants are going, wait a minute, you know, is this another cost that we're burdening?
There are no fees for anybody who's in compliance. And our attempt is not to generate revenue from this. Our hope is that we generate no revenue. Our hope is that we have everyone in compliance and that we don't, all we have basically is a continuing education program. So we just... Right.
Well, then who pays for the employee then?
All sewer utility customers then will, through the sewer bill.
So then we eliminate that. Because I think the concern is that the more people that come compliant, the more the person that's needing to create these fees is digging for issues and it becomes, you know... I'm just saying that that's what we're hearing from the restaurant. So I think... You know, the Hospitality First, the Rochester Restaurant Association, you know, some of those groups, if we could get some little opportunities to help them understand this, it would be a lot easier for us to support it because, you know, they're already dealing with a lot of fees and costs and taxes and things that they're dealing with, and for us to make sure that they understand this is a positive thing if they do it properly would be a good thing.
We're not making them do anything that they're not required to do already.
Mr. Wood.
And that's my whole take on the thing, too, is I agree, you know, education, once we have this approved, and you know, there should be some outreach, and I'm sure that, you know, we can probably get the column written up in the paper explaining it as well. But you know, I don't have any sympathy for any business that's dumping grease illegally into our sewers right now either. I mean, just, you know, they're supposed to be doing this stuff already anyways, and a lot of them aren't. So I get that this is a cost of doing business, but saving that cost by illegally dumping grease in our sewers is not okay either. And you know, the fact that this is not is not going to be effectively an increase in fees on these makes it a little bit easier to sell. And the one caveat though is when you talked about the funding of the program, you know, it's true that this isn't intended to be a moneymaker, but it does seem like the just using the energy from the digesters is going to help offset the cost of this position quite a bit anyways. And way to really pin down the financials on that too. I see you had a range like from $1 to $1 million. No, from $200,000 to $2 million. And
I think it depends on how large the program becomes.
Oh,
we don't,
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Fog there is out there to treat. I mean, we actually think that a lot of revenue will come from non-restaurants and some of the industries and stuff. I mean, right now, fog has to be hauled to Wisconsin, the Twin Cities, to properly dispose of it. So.
I suspect a lot of surrounding communities are probably going to latch on to this then as well. On the technical side, I mean, are the digesters, are they scalable and how we're going to produce them, or do we have to figure out what size we're going with them?
Well, currently we have six digesters.
Yep.
Two of them are very old, not sufficient. So we have two online, and we're using about 60% of their capacity right mm-hmm. now. And we have a third one that we use as backup. So technically, it's available. So we're about 50% capacity right now.
Okay.
So as we start to get fog, we start using up that portion until we get to 100%. If we get to 100%, we would have generated enough revenue that this would be a very easy decision. This would be a good problem because we'd be paying for it as it goes along. But for now, in the near foreseeable future, the next 3, 4, 5 years, there's no issues whatsoever.
Oh, okay. So we got time to figure this out then.
We have time.
On the capital side.
We have a fourth digester that is totally connected up. We just have to buy some flow meters and some control valves, and that's ready to go also.
Oh, outstanding.
So we're in good shape. We have two old digesters that are available to go online.
Mr. Ruska.
Richard, you said the Olmsted, the County Health Department, just declined to take this on at all. They just don't want to. I don't believe it's because I know it's one of the things I heard from restaurants too. Is they're already coming in and they're the ones that are closest to this right now. And why would we create a whole other process?
It's not in their purview. They don't have the time and the staffing to do it, to take on that additional responsibility is what it really boils down to.
It wouldn't be that much to check. I mean, you're already going in the kitchen. You're already helping them with creating their kitchen setup and all the things that are done. I would think that would be just another facet of what they do.
We went down that road and didn't. Again, it's not that they didn't want to help. They just said they couldn't. They couldn't take that workload on, and they didn't want that responsibility. So,
Ms. Means.
I was searching for an email that I received, and you all may have received it as well, from one of the restaurant owners. And she was speaking about oil disposal restaurants. She says, while this may seem like a straightforward issue, it is one of those issues that had many facets and many implications, not only for the city, but our city as well as our small businesses. And the request was to wait on making a decision so all sides could be educated about it.
Mm-hmm. And again, given the nature of the committee of the whole, I think there would be that opportunity.
Other questions? A couple of points in the ordinance, and then we'll move over to the fee schedule. So 76C07, records and record keeping. Again, this is actually a requirement that's in the statute. And this is a really important part of the overall program, is that the FSC keeps track of what their grease disposal record has been. They said, how often is it being done? And basically, there's going to be some information we provide them. We have some reports that they need to have, a sheet or something on the wall there that basically shows kind of like an elevator inspection, but it would be an interceptor inspection that's been done, and it would be recorded to be visible to the people who come in to the inspection. So that's a critical important point. And then 76C09, and then the best management practices will again be part of the education and training that we conduct. And then the fees are in 76C10. And I think with that, I'd like to segue to the memo on the fees. Again, obviously the council has the prerogative not to initiate this program without any fees, if that's what you want to do. We're just coming back and suggesting that these would be reflective of what our costs would be if, in fact, we were to conduct, say, re-inspections. We're not proposing that the initial inspection in any given year at any given time is that there's any fee associated with that. But if we have to go back because you're in non-compliance, that re-inspection fee, we're suggesting that there should be a charge to that. We should reward those who are in compliance, and again, at the expense of those who aren't. So again, there will never be an inspection fee unless you adopt one. We're not proposing one, but there will be. We're suggesting that there would be a re-inspection fee if we have to go back because of non-compliance. The sewer utility surcharge fee, as I explained earlier, would be charged to any FSC that does not have a grease interceptor. This helps, promote the installation of a grease interceptor, but also provides a more equitable treatment for those FSCs with ownership and operating costs for their interceptor who have to, who are compliant and are paying somebody to come and haul their grease away and dispose of it. They are paying to have it cleaned and regularly monitored. And those who don't, we're suggesting, should have some sort of a surcharge that would reflect our estimate of the cost to treat their fog discharge to the collection system, because it's going into the sewers, it's going into the lift stations, it's being treated, so there is a city cost for all of that. The exemption application fees, as I indicated, that would allow people to apply for an exemption. We're fully intending to be very, very lenient in this as far as making sure people can apply for an exemption. Again, we ultimately want everybody to be in compliance, but there's going to be no strong arming of anybody at this point. It's just basically, okay, we're going to put you on a compliance schedule. Your exemption will basically, again, say that if and when you expand your facility, then you'll have to come in compliance with the ordinance, but not until then.
How about point of sale?
We haven't suggested that. That is an option, but
my only concern is that we have, some of these places that are probably going to operate as a status quo forever. I mean, that
would be another option, another timeline, if you will, for when that can happen.
And that's the reason why we propose the surcharge fee, because there are some people that will do that.
What is the capital cost for somebody to put one of these gravity?
Gravity interceptor?
Yeah.
Nominally, it's about $7,500.
Okay, so that does pay off over some period of time.
Hydromechanical is only about $1,500. It's required, though. Yeah. Any place will end to require to have an interceptor.
That's new construction. I would say your costs double and triple considerably if, in fact, you're trying to retrofit an existing space.
If you're downtown trying to fit something, you know, the blue one.
$600 a year at least gets you thinking about it. Yeah.
The administrative citation is suggested, again, is basically just in case of those cases where upon a reinspection, they still haven't come into compliance. So now this is your second chance and you haven't come into compliance. We are suggesting a citation be written consistent with the provisions of Chapter 5, where $60 is the first-time offense. And then it would go up after that if, in fact, there were continued reinspections and non-compliance. So again, it would only be implemented if upon a reinspection they still were not in compliance. And then the disposal fee. This is $30 per 1,000 gallons. This is currently about a third of what we charge for the receiving septage at the plant from portable toilets and septic tanks and other things like that.
And that's also for a full load. If you're a hydromechanical, you're going to get 20 to 50 gallons. So you're going to probably have six of these in one tanker when they come out. So that $30 can be divided amongst five, six, seven, as many as 10 customers.
Now, what we don't regulate is what the hauler charges to the FSC. We don't regulate that. We can't regulate that. But what we're charging the hauler is the $30 per 1,000 gallons. But we don't regulate, and we really have no way of regulating how much the hauler charges to clean out the interceptor or to pump it clean. So those are some suggested revenues, or program fees, if you will, that would potentially offset some of the cost. And then the third handout that was sent to you was the program cost and again, potential revenues, just showing that initially we think that probably the program can pay for itself, not that it should. And if your decision was not to charge any fees or any surcharge, that's obviously your decision to make. But this would be our estimate in the first probably 2 to 3 years of what we would expect in the way of revenues as it might relate to reinspections, administrative fines, surcharges. And again, this is really, quite honestly, a guess, because as we showed with the survey, we really don't know how many people currently have an interceptor at all. If only half do, you're going to be collecting a lot more money than in surcharge fees than you are any other particular revenue source here.
So this is something that business FSCs are required to do anyway, right?
Correct.
And we're essentially codifying that, updating our ordinance.
And so basically giving them some better direction on what they're supposed to do then. They have this facility that they're supposed to clean regularly and keep records for regularly.
Right.
And they're supposed to dispose of it. Well, we haven't offered them the opportunity to dispose of it here locally. And that's really the big significant change here is now we are going to start accepting this. They don't have to haul it to La Crosse. They don't have to haul it to Madison. They don't have to haul it to the Twin Cities. They can be disposed of here locally. We can benefit from that as it might relate to some energy savings at the facility. But we also then benefit from not having as many sewer blockages and grease buildups in the collection system.
So if they're required to do it anyway, and we're going to, pardon the pun, grease the skids so that they can get rid of it more easily. Hey, I had to say, come on.
Working on that. I've been waiting all day.
No.
I've been writing them all down.
He's a slippery one.
But so if I turn the tables a little bit, why would a business object? Or, I mean, it could be that they just don't fully understand it yet. Why would they object to this? What's the downside?
I think you hit it right on the head. They don't understand it. They don't understand what's being proposed. They think that there are going to be fees and charges, and if they're in non-compliance, yes, there will be, but the ones that are won't be. And I think the other thing is they don't understand that everybody's grandfathered in. Nobody's required to do anything different now and won't be until we do an inspection, and then we kind of establish what the baseline is for everybody going forward. If you don't have a facility in place, an interceptor, you'll now start having to pay a surcharge. You'll also know that in the future, when you want to expand, or potentially at the point of sale, you may have to put in an interceptor. And in doing so, then you may have to pay the surcharge.
So,
and if you're currently doing everything as per the state planning code, you'll save money. Because our cost to dispose of the plant is reduced. It's reduced from what a normal would be to take it to, obviously, to take it to Wisconsin or Iowa or someplace else in the city to get a transportation cost. And even if it was septic, the septic would be $93 per thousand. We're charging $30. It checks out as septic rate. We're charging $30, just an administrative fee. And it's even going to be less than that for the hydro mechanical because there are more than one on site.
Mr. Ruska.
I guess I'm wondering, how do we shape up against other cities in the area, the state, and the, you know, Midwest? You know, right now it sounds like a good deal for our local, you know, reasonable for everybody, but, you know, one of the things we always hear is how come we don't get a new restaurant, you know, what it takes to get new restaurants, keep that building of new companies coming to town, so new ones would have to deal with this then. So I'm wondering, does this change our advantage or put us at a disadvantage at all to other cities in the Midwest?
We're not requiring anybody to do anything that they're not already required to do with any place else in the state.
Okay.
Because it's a state plumbing code that dictates the time and place, if not the time, but the locations where these must be installed.
But are other cities enforcing it?
I don't know that. All I know is that it's the state plumbing code. So it's...
So I'm just getting the sense that we're kind of stepping out and doing, being more aggressive on this than any other city in the area. So I guess I'm just, you know, I'm just trying to understand this because it makes a lot of sense, but I also...
I think it's fair to say that we're probably out front as far as creating a fog ordinance. But again, I don't think that you'll find many cities that don't have an ordinance very similar to ours, our Chapter 76A, that basically prohibits the discharge. And many cities that don't have a plumbing code that requires the installation of an interceptor.
The only municipality I know that would be more aggressive than ours is to do, and they are much more. But they had an incredible amount of problems with fog backups. So they're under a consent decree from the EPA to have a program. So they just put a program in. They didn't necessarily follow the guidelines from the state plumbing code by the letter. They just said, you got to put one in, you got to put it outside, you got to do this, you got to do this, you got to do this. And they could do that because they're under a consent decree. So they're very restrictive right now.
Okay, well,
we're not nearly that restrictive.
As Nick said in our last thing here, I think, you know, we're looking for balance, make sure that, you know, we're doing everything we can for proper maintenance, but also making sure we don't put our businesses at a competitive disadvantage.
Right, so. And I think the one thing that we've struggled with, and I'm just, again, being very honest with you, is that as it relates to the surcharge fee, a 12-seat restaurant versus a 120-seat restaurant, to charge them both $50 surcharge, is that fair? And so, you know, how do you do that? And so, again, you could go... based on, you know, up to 50 seats would be X, and from 50 seats to 200 seats would be a different number. We've thought about that. We really don't have a good way. We actually worked with our lab staff to figure, is there a way we can actually measure this stuff and determine quantity-wise how much might be coming, and it's not an easy test that we can do and have any confidence in the reliability of the results. So that's one thing, I guess, if there is something on the sheet that I personally think right now may not be equitable. It's that small restaurant, medium-sized restaurant, and large restaurant all paying the same surcharge.
Mr. Campion.
I lost it after that comment. But I guess I like the idea of scaling it with the seat. I think that's important. Oh, I remember. Why is this not already being enforced by the plumbing code? If this is already a requirement, why are buildings being allowed through our building process that are not already enforcing this?
We are enforcing that.
Yes.
Building code came into effect in 1972, so we had a lot of existing restaurants, existing grocery stores that were existing, so they didn't have to meet any type of code. But as we are encountering these things, as they're remodeling, we're getting them to put grease interceptors.
Okay, and so these they were presented somewhat as charity cases where a restaurant comes in and decides to put in a grease interceptor. They're just deciding not to break the law is what it sounds like. Is that... Okay, all right. Well, and it's not that I think that. I'm all for trying to figure out a way that this breaks even. I actually like the idea of trying to set a sliding fee for how those...
Oh, for the love of God.
setting a sliding fee based on the number of seats, I think that's reasonable. Yeah, I would even say 50 cents. I mean, it sounds like cap it at 100, say 50 cents per seat, and move on with it. But other than that, I mean, I think this has kind of got to go into effect. So.
Mr. Woodruff?
Well, just from a practical standpoint, if we're going to do that, it's going to be a lot easier to look at square feet than it is going to be seats. Because that's, I think staff actually agrees with me, so there must be something to it. The two changes that I'd really like to see, and these are both incredibly minor, is I do think that we should address point of sale. And it doesn't necessarily have to be fix it. It can be a very explicit disclosure that they're in violation of the code and the law, because that'll effectively force them to fix it anyways. But I do think we need to handle that point of sale, because some of these are just going to sit around forever and never get fixed up if they deem the...
I don't understand what that is.
Yeah.
Can you explain it?
Oh, I'm sorry. What that means is that at a time of sale, if we know that there's something under that's not up to code...
Oh, okay. Sale of the building.
Yeah,
sale
they have
to. Business or whatever? Yeah.
Yep, okay. If you're selling a business, so the next people don't get stuck with something unexpectedly. And then the other thing too is, and this is probably a more limited area, but I would like to, the way this is crafted, it's very careful to never have us forcing them to make these updates. But, you know, I do think there's a situation if we're actually, and maybe we're not seeing this, but if we're actually suffering backups and clogged pipes, then it would be, I think at that point, I think we need to be a little bit more aggressive in having whatever might be upstream of that dealing with it.
We've got that in there.
You do?
Downstream, there's two clauses. One clause says if there's backups and fog grease collecting downstream, then they'll be forced to go through the next level of mystery citation, that factor. The other thing is we can go downstream and we can actually grab a sample of the fog, and it's above 100 milligrams per liter, then they're required to clean at more frequent time.
Okay.
It's a difficult test, but you know, we can do it. So it's covered as best we can.
And it would be through a notice of violation, and then basically they would have a compliance schedule. Not compliance, but schedule could basically be as much as a year for them to
that's
compliance. So again, it's not so urgent that, I mean, there's somebody right out there today that tomorrow they've got to fix this. Okay? We're going to work with them, and we're going to give them a reasonable period of time to come in compliance. And like I say, they're all grandfathered in until they start making some changes.
I know Mark and I have that experience of people having sewage in their basements, and generally speaking, they do not like it.
Agreed. Mr. Bildebeck, are there certain types of restaurants that produce more fog than others?
Yes.
Is that, have you thought about how you charge based on the type of restaurants, the production?
We thought about it. Okay. We try to keep it as simple as possible.
Yeah. No, I understand. I'm just, so. But I mean, if there's a group out there that's a major producer and dumping it.
Some cities will have a list probably that would include, I would say just for restaurants alone, it might be 12 or 15 different rates, sewer rates that they charge based on the type of restaurant, the type of food that you serve. Because of, again, the ability, the type of waste that potentially is going down the drain from an Asian restaurant versus a restaurant that serves red meat and chicken and things like that versus, you know, it's all over the board.
Okay.
Yeah. So, again, we're trying to keep it as simple as we could and make it as equitable as we could.
That's fine. Okay. Other questions, comments?
I have a question for you then. What would you like us to do with this? Would you like us to...
Well, that was going to be my next question.
I suggest then that, again, our intent... Again, we have a couple things we're working against here. One is an implementation time frame. So what would you like? I've suggested the first of the year. That gives us plenty of time to do the public education. But my question really to you is, do you want the public education to occur before this ordinance is read the second time, before it's read the first time? You want it to occur after the ordinance is in place? I need some direction for you on where to go next.
Mr. Hickey?
Yeah, I definitely would like to see this continue to go forward, but I think just everything we've discussed, just the feedback I've been getting, I think it is really a matter of education, that people think there's something, you know, new coming in, there's going to be new regulations, requirements. So I think I'd like to see us continue to move this forward so we can get it implemented in a timely manner, but also start that education right now.
And I would agree with that. If it's really as benign as we think it is, I mean, it's a requirement. There's lots of advantages, you know, no fee if you're compliant, et cetera. Perhaps with that education, some detractors might say, oh, I guess it's not a big deal I thought it was. Mr. Rusk?
I guess, you know, the note that I forwarded on today was from Dan McElroy from the Minnesota Restaurant Association. And I would think if you could work with him to not only educate our local people, but, you know, I mean, this would be impactful statewide, that I think it would be, have a meeting, an open meeting with them to say, okay, we're going to come in and give you a little bit of understanding and listen to your questions. That would go a long way to making this thing really become a reality, because I think it has a lot of real positives, but I think there's some confusion and misunderstanding out there. And these are the users, these are the people that are going to be, you know, immediately affected by it. Obviously, we're all affected by it in the big picture, but that would be what I would suggest, is the sooner we get that done and get that kind of behind us, then we can move forward.
So you want to do all of that before you see this on your agenda for a first reading?
I would say yes.
I think we're moving in parallel.
Piece.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're moving in parallel.
Well, first reading could be as early as next meeting.
Well, that is his time. Mr. Gosley is handling that, and he's out until after the first reading. So I prefer
but I guess my concern, there's that feeling out there that we're, you know, that there is not enough chance for people to fully understand this. So I don't know why we'd try to hurry it through. I mean, that would be my only concern is, you know, you don't want to make it look like you're trying to hurry it through. We aren't. We want to be open about it. So
that's why I want to know what your schedule is.
That's why I don't know why we'd.
Mr. Campion,
is the education predicated on the hiring of the new FOG coordinator?
Well, let me start with this, Rich. You can finish up. Ultimately, yes.
Sorry.
But we have put up a position for a summer intern, environmental engineering intern, to help us start with the education process. The resumes are out right now. We're reviewing them. They're on my desk right now. We would like to hire somebody next week. They're going to start with the summer, you know, when they're off for summer, and they would start developing the education materials. So what we really need is to know that we definitely want to go in that direction. We love to have them start talking to the actual restaurant owners. It's easy talking to the plumbers. The others have a plumbing association. It's easy doing with the haulers. Some of the others, the food service establishments, are more difficult. So we'd like to have this person start talking to them, explaining the program, developing the binder with requirements, all that material, and start talking to them. The only question is, you know, would it be this is a proposed program, you know, this is in the works, and that sort of thing. But
Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, and I might have used the wrong term. When I talk about education, this piece of it is educating people on what we're trying to do right now, mm-hmm. not necessarily sitting down with every restaurant owner and comprehensively, you know, doing the ongoing education that we're going to do once it's in place. Just kind of at kind of the department level, just outreach with, you know, the restaurant association. Obviously, there's going to be some point people in this that hopefully if we can get that information out on some of these, you know, these point people, it'll go a long way in moving this forward. So whatever term we're using for that, I don't know if that's public relations as opposed to education, whatever we're calling it.
I think, just again, thinking at the top of my head right now, what I'll do is take Mr. Rusk up on his offer here and meet with the Restaurant Association
sure.
group to start with, work with them jointly on the letter that goes out to their membership and the other FSEs that are on the list. I'd like to get that out. That's something Chet and I can work on, again, with hopefully their cooperation. Get that out probably by the end of April, and then probably schedule something to come before you in May or June, something like that.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Mr. Bildeback?
Well, I was going to say, let's just back it up a little bit more. I like the idea about getting the education. I'd like to see this move forward, but if you're not going to implement it until the intent is January 1st, why don't we just say back it up and say the first reading gives you time to have that ready and the education done by the second meeting of October. That would still give us an opportunity to get this read and have it on the books by the 1st of January. It gives you a chance to really come up with a really solid education.
That's entirely your prerogative. Again, our thought was that if you were going forward with this, hopefully we could get the position filled and that person would have 6 months in order to get people up to speed
okay.
and we would start...
All right.
Start doing inspections yet this year.
Yeah. I'd like to see this move forward.
But
I do think the education needs to start sooner than later.
Yeah.
I guess if you would just let's do the letter. Let's work with the restaurant association. Let's see where that gets us at the time of the first reading, and see if we need to adjust the plan
okay.
at that point.
I can live with that,
Mr. Roger.
I was just
my two cents is I just want to make sure that the second reading is done with at least a quarter to go before the implementation is in.
Yeah, I agree. Let's let it take what it takes.
I'm happy. I'm happy to go whenever. I do think we need to articulate our consensus on two points. One is, do we want to adjust fees based on restaurant size? And the second one is a point of sale criteria okay?
I think the point of sale makes really good sense.
And variation on restaurant size using square footage as the denominator works.
Okay.
I'll include language to that effect in the letter then, and then the final decision obviously will be made by you in adoption of the resolution.
Okay.
Multiplier if they do fish fries. Just
all
kidding,
right.
Just kidding.
Does that give you some guidance then?
It does. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. All right. Anything else for this afternoon on the agenda?
Does that FOG coordinator have to be considered during the upcoming budget year?
Or do you have to authorize it whenever you would feel like you should need to do so?
And the funds would come from?
The sewer fund.
Okay. Thank you.
Excuse me. I have one more question that I forgot.
Go ahead.
At one point during the presentation, there was discussion on how the sewer fund wouldn't be able to support any sort of incentive to bring non-compliant systems into compliance. Is there any opportunity, or could we consider an opportunity to do like a low-interest loan backed by the sewer fund to bring some of these non-compliant businesses into compliance to help support some of those businesses where they might get a 3x the time the cost to come into compliance? No opportunity.
Loaning is restricted to economic development.
Okay. That's too bad. I think that some of the commentary I heard from small business was definitely about the initial cost of coming into compliance, and I know we're going to grandfather them all in, but when we're having some of this downtown development and we're going to see some changes in some of those buildings, they could hit those events where, you know, it might not always be reasonable to install one of these units without some support. So
is it something you could do through CDBG?
Well, that's what I was just thinking, that possibly, I suppose, under the slum and blight removal category, conceivably, but unfortunately, there's not much money in the block grant program to work with. That's kind of the biggest issue.
And I really think most of your FSCs have the interceptors. I think they're installed and they're built. A lot of them just aren't aware of it.
Okay.
So I think once they're educated and they do an inspection, they find that they're there. Hopefully they're still working. That's probably not it. They have to rebuild and just be in the work.
Will you keep track of that, Chet?
Yes.
I'd like to see, I think we're going to want a comprehensive report after, 6 months to figure out where this is at, so we can figure out what we want to do going forward.
Our initial survey was a lot of, we just don't know.
Okay.
Is this something that we could tour and look at? Or I've seen the pictures. I've seen the pictures.
Sure.
I've seen the pictures.
You headed down a slippery slope.
I'll take the pictures word for it.
Just take a few pictures, Leah.
I've seen the pictures.
We can do ride alongs.
Let me know
the
police
department.
Don't ever ride along with a snowplow driver.
Anything else then for this afternoon? Then we are adjourned. Thank you.
Hey, Michael, I had one thing for you real quick. I'm probably getting a lot of the same comments you are.
Energy.